We abandoned the story last night with the Genoa Conference system. Genoa system in the 1920s having collapsed, with Britain having gone off the gold standard, Europe having gone off the gold standard, and then the United States finally in 31, then the United States in 33, and then when the United States goes off the gold standard and the dollar devalues, the British suddenly found that the glories of the devaluation of the pound might have another side of the coin, which is the dollar also might be devalued, and then they were in real trouble. So the British proposed a World Economic Conference in London in June 1933 to try to reestablish a workable international monetary system, because what they could see looming ahead of them is what, of course, eventually did loom ahead of them. Competing devaluations, fiat, paper monies, currency blocks, exchange controls, world tariff wars, and so forth and so on, leading to World War II, as we'll go into also. So they saw this prospect looming ahead, didn't like it, and then so the conference was called. I can resume reading from this tract. Preparations for the conference had been underway for a year under the guidance of a League of Nations, which reads, parenthesis, Britain. In a desperate attempt to aid the world economic and financial crisis by attempting, quote, the restoring of the currencies on a healthy basis. Let's get this Incidentally, on the World Economic Conference, an excellent book which I recommend by Leo Pasvolsky called Current Monetary Issues, published by Brookings in 1933, which is a detailed study of this whole. Pasvolsky is one of the people at the conference. It's a detailed study of the whole business. The Hoover administration was planning to urge the restoration of the international gold standard, but the abandonment of gold by the Roosevelt administration in March and April 1933 changed the American position radically. As the conference loomed ahead, it was clear that there were three fundamental positions. The gold bloc, the country still on the gold standard, headed by France. France had been a hard money country since the late 20s, which desired immediate, and incidentally, France was the great French monetary advisor at the time, the Bank of France. There was Charles Reese, I mentioned, was one. Another one was Jacques Rouef, who's still in there now in the 70s. He was de Gaulle's great gold standard economic advisor, which almost busted the dollar system in 68, which was prevented by the French Revolution of 68, or the French General Strike of 68. Maybe we work out some conspiracy thing there, you know, the CIA spurring on the malice or something in 68 and busting the de Gaulle hard money position. At any rate, that's pure speculation, of course. So we have, and Jacques Rouef is still the great hard money gold standard person. It was clear that the gold bloc, the country still on the gold standard, headed by France, which desired immediate return to a full international gold standard with fixed exchange rates between the major currencies and gold. The United States, which now placed greatest stress on domestic inflation of the price level, so we were the most inflationist country. We are again now, by the way, so we've come back full circle. It's almost the cause of Bill's cyclical theory of history, except here the cycles come like every 20 years. And the British, supported by their dominions, wish some form of combination of the two things. At least the United States position, although bad, was coherent, and the French position was coherent, but the British position, the British somehow wanted to have that cake and eat it also, have some kind of fixed and fluctuating and whatever. At the invitation of President Roosevelt, what was still unclear was whether a satisfactory compromise between these divergent views could be worked out. At the invitation of President Roosevelt, Prime Minister Ramsay MacDonald of Great Britain, leading statesmen of the other major countries, journeyed to Washington for individual talks with the president. It's supposed to be sort of like a preparation for the big conference. All that emerged from these conversations were vague agreements of intent. But the most interesting aspect of the talks was an American proposal, originated by William C. Bullitt and rejected by the French, to establish a coordinated worldwide inflation and devaluation of currencies. And here we get to one of the first evidences of what's really the great American dream, which is right now the great American establishment dream, which is a coordinated worldwide inflation with a World Bank and that sort of stuff, a world paper unit. Bullitt didn't go into this whole thing. That's the current American goal. Pasvolsky writes, there was serious discussion of a proposal sponsored by the United States and vigorously opposed by the gold countries that the whole world should embark upon a cheaper money policy, not only through a vigorous and concerted program of credit expansion and the stimulation of business enterprise by means of public works, but also through a simultaneous devaluation by a fixed percentage of all currencies which are still at their pre-depression parities. So we have this idea of this coordinated worldwide inflation. The American delegation to London was a mixed bag, but the conservative gold standard forces could take heart from the fact that staff economic advisor was James P. Warburg of Kuhn Moab and Company, who had been eagerly working on a plan for international currency stabilization based on gold at new and realistic parities. In other words, the idea is, all right, forget about the old parities. This is the same sort of thing I was talking about in the early 20s. We accept the current devalued parities and we reestablish the gold standard at a more workable level. Furthermore, conservative Professor Oliver M.W. Sprague and George L. Harrison, governor of the New York Fed, who had succeeded Strong, were sent to discuss proposals for temporary stabilization of the major currencies. You stabilize the thing for the duration of the conference. In contrast, the president paid no attention to the petition of 85 congressmen, including 10 senators, that he appointed as economic advisor to the conference the radical inflationist and anti-gold priest Father Charles E. Coughlin. This is sort of one of the high points in current American history. 10 senators and 75 congressmen petitioned the president to appoint Father Coughlin as his economic advisor. The World Economic Conference, attended by delegates from 64 major nations, opened in London on June the 12th. The first crisis occurred over the French suggestion for a temporary so-called currency truce, a de facto stabilization of exchange rates between the franc, dollar, and pound for the duration of the conference. Surely eminently reasonable, the plan was also a clever device for an entering wedge toward a hopefully permanent stabilization of exchange rates on a full gold basis. The British were amenable, provided the pound remained fairly cheap in relation to the dollar. That was their shtick. They were willing to go along with almost anything as long as the pound was cheap in relation to the dollar. So that they could export stuff to us and we couldn't export as much stuff to them. So that their export advantage gained since 1931 would not be lost. On June 16th, Sprague and Harrison concluded an agreement with the British and French for temporary stabilization of the three currencies, setting the dollar sterling rate at about $4 per pound, and pledging the United States not to engage in massive inflation of the currency for the duration of the agreement. The American representatives urged Roosevelt to accept the agreement, Sprague warning, quote, that a failure now would be most disastrous, and Warburg declaring that without stabilization, quote, it would be practically impossible to assume a leading role in attempting to bring about a lasting economic peace, unquote. But Roosevelt quickly rejected the agreement on June 17th, giving two reasons. One, that the pound must be stabilized at no cheaper than $4.25. In other words, we can't accept a $4 pound. We've got to push the pound up again so that American exports would be stimulated and British exports stopped or restricted. And two, that he could not accept any restraint on his freedom of action to inflate in order to raise domestic prices. Roosevelt ominously concluded, quote, that it is my personal view that far too much importance is being placed on existing and temporary fluctuations. Unquote. Unless the American delegation take his reasoning as a stimulus to renegotiating the agreement, Roosevelt reminded Hull on June 20th, quote, remember that far too much influence is attached to exchange stability by banker-influenced cabinets, unquote. Here we have a new note of anti-banker hostility. Upon receiving the presidential veto, the British and French were indignant, and George Harrison quit and returned home to disgust. That was the first great resignation from the Roosevelt team. But the American delegation went ahead and issued its official statement on temporary currency stabilization on June 22nd. It declared temporary stabilization impermissible, quote, because the American government feels that its efforts to raise prices are the most important contribution it can make. That already cast a great pall on the conference, obviously. Not a very happy foot to start off on. With temporary stabilization scuttle, the conference settled down to longer-range discussions, the most important work being centered on the subcommission on immediate measures of financial reconstruction of the Monetary and Financial Commission of the conference. The British delegation began by introducing a draft resolution, one emphasizing the importance of, quote, cheap and plentiful credit, unquote, in order to raise the world level of commodity prices, and two stating that the central banks of the principal countries should undertake to cooperate with a view to securing these conditions and should announce their intention of pursuing vigorously a policy of cheap and plentiful money by open market operations. So essentially, this is sort of the bullet thing. You emphasize coordinated, all the countries get together and coordinate an inflationary policy, cheap credit policy, and open market operations. The British thus laid stress on coordinated inflation, but said nothing about the sticking point, exchange rate stabilization. The Dutch, the Czechoslovaks, the Japanese, and the Swiss criticized the British advocacy of inflation, and the Italian delegate warned, quote, that to put one's faith in immediate measures for augmenting the volume of money and credit might lead to a speculative boom followed by an even worse slump. And so the Austrian motif. A hasty and unregulated flood of credit will lead to destructive results. And the French delegates stressed that no genuine recovery could occur without a sense of economic and financial security. Quote, French delegate, who would be prepared to lend with a fear of being repaid in depreciated currency always before his eyes? Who would find the capital for financing vast programs of economic recovery and abolition of unemployment as long as there is a possibility that economic struggles will be transported to the monetary field? In other words, as long as you have the specter of competing devaluations, etc. In a word, without stable currency, there can be no lasting confidence. While the hoarding of capital continues, there can be no solution. The American delegation then submitted its own draft proposal, which was similar to the British, ignored currency stability, and advocated close cooperation between all governments and central banks, quote, for the carrying out of a policy of making credit abundantly and readily available to sound enterprise, especially by open market operations which expanded the money supply. Also, government expenditures and deficits should be synchronized between the different nations. So it's the same sort of thing, coordinated inflation. The difference of views between the nations on inflation and prices, however, precluded any agreement in this area at the conference. On the gold question, Great Britain submitted a policy declaration, the U.S. a draft resolution, which looked forward to eventual restoration of the gold standard. But again, nothing was spelled out on exchange rates or on the crucial question of whether restoration of price inflation should come first. I mean, restoration or price inflation should come first. So sort of a pious hope about the gold standard, somewhere off in the future. In both the American and British proposals, however, even the eventual gold standard would be considerably more inflationary than it had been in the 20s. For all domestic gold circulation, whether coin or bullion, would be abolished. This was very clear, not vague, in the British and the American resolutions. And gold used only as a medium for settling international balances of payment, and all gold reserve ratios to currency would be lowered. As could have been predicted before the conference, there were three sets of views on gold and currency stabilization. The United States, backed only by Sweden, favored cheap money in order to raise domestic prices, but currency stabilization to be deferred until a sufficient price rise had occurred. This is, again, the Fisher motif. Whatever international cooperation was envisaged would stress joint inflationary action to raise price levels in some coordinate manner. The United States, moreover, went further even than Sweden in calling for reflating wholesale prices back to 1926 levels. The gold bloc attacked currency and price inflation, pointed to the early post-war experience of severe inflation and currency depreciation, and hence insisted on stabilization of exchanges and the avoidance of depreciation. In the confused middle were the British and the sterling bloc, who wanted price reflation and cheap credit, but also wanted eventual return of the gold standard and temporary stabilization of the key currency. So again, we have this sort of polar thing. The French and the gold bloc on one hand, the United States on the other pole, and the British and sterling bloc in the middle. As the London conference founded on severe disagreements, the gold bloc countries began to panic. For on the one hand, the dollar was falling in the exchange markets all this time that they were talking, thus making American goods and currency more competitive. And what is more, the general gloom at the conference gave international speculators the idea that in the near future, many of these countries would themselves be forced to go off gold. In consequence, money began to flow out of the gold countries during June, and Holland and Switzerland lost over 10% of their gold reserve during that 1 month alone. Consequently, the gold countries launched a final attempt to draft a compromise resolution. The proposed resolution was a surprisingly mild one. It committed the signatory countries to reestablishing the gold standard and stable exchange rates, but deliberately emphasized that the parity and date for each country to return to gold was strictly up to each individual country. The existing gold standard countries were pledged to remain on gold, which is not difficult since that was their fervent hope. The non-gold countries were to reaffirm their ultimate objective to return to gold, to try their best to limit exchange speculation in the meanwhile, and to cooperate with other central banks in these two endeavors. The innocuousness, not a word really, of the proposed declaration comes from the fact that it committed the United States to very little more than its own resolution of over a week earlier to return eventually to the gold standard, coupled with a vague agreement to cooperate in limiting exchange speculation in the major currencies. This joint declaration was agreed upon by Sprague, Warburg, James M. Cox, head of the Monetary Commission of the conference, and by Raymond Moley, who had taken charge of the delegation as a freewheeling White House advisor. Moley was Assistant Secretary of State and had been a monetary nationalist. Moley, however, sent the declaration to Roosevelt on June 30th, urging the president to accept it, especially since Roosevelt had been willing a few weeks earlier to stabilize it at $4.25 a pound, while the depreciation of the dollar during June had now brought the market rate up to $4.40. So Roosevelt really had nothing to gripe about because the pound was happily expensive, more expensive, and up to $4.40. Of course, the Atlantic Undersecretary of Treasury Dean Goodham Acheson, who appears for the first time as a powerful figure in America, influential Wall Street financier Bernard M. Baruch, and Lewis W. Douglas also strongly endorsed the London Declaration. Not hearing immediately from the president, Moley frantically wired Roosevelt the next morning that, quote, success, even continuance of the conference depends upon the United States agreement. Roosevelt cabled his rejection on July 1st, declaring, quote, that a sufficient interval should be allowed the United States to permit a demonstration of the value of price-lifting efforts which we have well in hand, the value of the inflation upward. Roosevelt's rejection of even the innocuous agreement was in itself startling enough, but he felt that he had to add insult to injury to slash away the London conference so that no danger might exist of currency stabilization or the reconstruction of an international monetary order. Hence, he sent on July 3rd an arrogant and contemptuous public message to the London conference, the famous bombshell message, so named for its impact on the conference. Roosevelt began by lambasting the idea of temporary currency stabilization, which he termed a specious fallacy, an artificial and temporary diversion. Instead, Roosevelt declared that the emphasis must be placed on, quote, the sound internal economic system of a nation. In particular, quote, old fetishes of so-called international bankers are being replaced by efforts to plan national currencies with the objective of giving to those currencies a continuing purchasing power, which a generation hence will have the same purchasing and debt-paying power as the dollar value we hope to attain in the near future. That's the thing, the Fisher motif of stabilization of the dollar. You can see, of course, how successful Roosevelt and his successors have been at this, pegging him at the price level. That objective means more to the good of other nations than a fixed ratio for a month or two in terms of a pound or a franc. Unquote. In short, the president was now totally committed to the nationalist Fisher-Committee of the Nation program for paper money, currency inflation, and a very steep reflation of prices, and then stabilization at the higher internal price level. The idea of stable exchange rates and international monetary order could fade into limbo. The World Economic Conference limped along aimlessly for a few more weeks, but the Roosevelt bombshell message effectively killed the conference, and the hope for a restored international monetary order was dead for a fateful decade. From here on in the 1930s, monetary nationalism, currency blocks, and commercial and financial warfare would be the order of the day. The French were bitter, and the English stricken at the Roosevelt message. The chagrined James P. Warburg promptly resigned as financial advisor of the delegation. This was to be the beginning of the exit of this highly placed economic advisor from the Roosevelt administration. A similar fate was in store for Oliver Sprague and Dean Acheson. You know, one peculiar thing about Dean Acheson is a sort of an aside here. When I was growing up, or first entered the movement, in quotes, Dean Acheson was considered to be a commie. I mean, the international Moscow conspirator, right? Because he refused to turn his back on Alger Hiss, and he lost us China. And then the peculiar thing is, you look at the later record of Dean Acheson, you find he's very conservative and he wants to bomb the Russians everywhere and so forth and so on. And then you say, well, maybe he was a leftist back in the 40s and he turned right wing, turned conservative in the 50s and 60s. But then you look back at the early 30s and of course he was very conservative then and he left the Roosevelt administration on the gold standard question. Which seems to indicate that he was not a commie in the 1940s. As for Raymond Moley, who had been repudiated by the president's action, he tried to restore himself to Roosevelt's graces by a fawning and obviously insincere telegram, only to be ousted from office shortly after his return to the United States. Playing an ambivalent role in the entire affair, Bernard Baruch, who was privately in favor of the old gold standard, praised Roosevelt fulsomely for his message. Quote, until each nation puts its house in order by the same Herculean efforts that you were performing, Baruch wrote the president, there can be no common denominators by which we can endeavor to solve the problems. There seems to be one common ground that all nations can take, and that is the one outlined by you, unquote. Here we have this fawning, bootlicking message by Baruch to Roosevelt. At the same time, he's telling his friends it's a terrible thing and we should have gone back to the old gold standard, which seems to cast a certain skeptical light on Baruch's noted and well-known beloved integrity. Reevaluate the Baruch integrity. Expressions of enthusiastic support for the president's decision came, as might be expected, from Irving Fisher and George F. Warren, who urged Roosevelt to avoid any possible agreement. that might, quote, limit our freedom to change the dollar any day. you might have to wait a week before you can juggle the exchange rate, and that would be a terrible thing. James A. Farley has recorded in his memoirs that Roosevelt was prompted to send his angry message by coming to suspect a plot to influence Moley in favor of stabilization by Thomas W. Lamont, partner of J.P. Morgan and Company, working through Moley's conference aide and White House advisor Herbert Bayard Swope, who was close to the Morgans and also a longtime confidant of Baruch. This might well account for Roosevelt's bitter reference to the so-called international bankers, in quotes. The situation is curious, however, since Swope was firmly on the anti-stabilizationist side, and Roosevelt's London message was greeted enthusiastically by Russell Leffingwell, a partner of J.P. Morgan, who apparently took little notice of its attack on the international bankers. Apparently, it rolled right off Russell Leffingwell's back. Leffingwell wrote to the president after he sent his message, the bombshell message, quote, "You were very right not to enter into any temporary or permanent arrangements to peg the dollar in relation to sterling or any other currency." So it's kind of a curious situation there, which needs some more wrapping up. From the date of the torpedoing of the London Monetary Conference, monetary nationalism prevailed for the remainder of the 1930s. The United States finally fixed the dollar at $35 an ounce in January 1934, amounting to a two-thirds increase in the gold price of the dollar from its original moorings less than a year before into a 40% devaluation of the dollar, which had been $20 an ounce. The gold nations continued on gold for two more years, but the greatly devalued dollar now began to attract a flood of gold from the gold countries, and France was finally forced off gold in the fall of 1936, with the other major gold countries, Switzerland, Belgium, and Holland, following shortly thereafter. While the dollar was technically fixed in terms of gold, there was no further gold coin or bullion redemption within the United States. Gold was used only as a method of clearing balances of payments, with only fitful redemption to foreign countries. In other words, we were technically paying foreign countries and foreign central banks, but we really did that only sort of fitfully when they really insisted on it. We try to get them not to insist on it. The only significant act of international collaboration after 1934 came in the fall of 36, at about the time France was forced to leave the gold standard. Partly to assist the French, the United States, Great Britain, and France entered into a tripartite agreement beginning on September 25, 1936. The French agreed to throw in the exchange rate sponge and devalue the franc by between one quarter and one-third. At this new par, the three governments agreed not to stabilize their currencies, but to iron out day-to-day fluctuations in them, to engage in mutual stabilization of each other's currencies only within each 24-hour period. So you have sort of like a day-to-day kind of stabilization. This was scarcely stabilization, but this constituted a moderating of fluctuations, as well as political-monetary collaboration, which began with the three Western countries and soon expanded to include the other former gold nations, Belgium, Holland, and Switzerland. This collaboration continued until the outbreak of World War II. So this was the United States, Great Britain, France, Belgium, Holland, and Switzerland. At least one incident marred the harmony of the tripartite agreement. In the fall of 1938, while the United States and Britain were hammering out a trade agreement, the British began pushing the pound below 480. At the threat of this cheapening of the pound, U.S. Treasury officials warned Secretary of Treasury Henry Morgenthau, Jr., that if, quote, sterling drops substantially below $4.80, our foreign and domestic business will be adversely affected, unquote. In consequence, Morgenthau successfully insisted that the trade agreement with Britain must include a clause that the agreement would terminate if Britain should allow the pound to fall below 480. So we are putting vigorous pressure on Britain to keep the pound at 480. We're all pro-British and all that, and all the, you know, the Nazi threat overseas looming up, but the British have got to keep the pound above 480 or else. Here we may touch only on a fascinating historical problem, which has been discussed by revisionist historians in the 1930s. To what extent was the American drive for war against Germany the result of anger and conflict over the fact that in the 1930s world of economic and monetary nationalism, the Germans, under the guidance of Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, went their way successfully on their own, totally outside of Anglo-American control or the confinements of what remained of the cherished American open door. Okay, get some more stuff here. A brief treatment of this question will serve as a prelude to examining the aim of the war-born Second New Deal of reconstructing the new international monetary order, an order that in many ways resembled the lost world of the 1920s. German economic nationalism in the 1930s was first of all conditioned by the horrifying experience that Germany had had with runaway inflation and currency depreciation during the early 1920s, culminating in the monetary collapse in 1923. The whole German shtick in this in the Depression starting in 1931, was shocked as the economic wizard, so to speak, so called, and continuing thereafter through the 30s, was totally conditioned by this experience. The Germans are going through this fantastic runaway inflation, the first hyperinflation of modern times of industrial nation. The mark was worth, you know, 2 billion marks were worth something like one piece of bubble gum, and people were papering the wall with mark notes and trillion mark notes and all the rest of it. So, and the German public latched on as a sort of a symbol and the cause of all this exchange rate devaluation exchange rate. So even though the Germans could cunningly increase the money supply, the supply of marks in Germany, they could not, regardless of who was in power, devalue the mark. So the fixed thing which the Germans had to face in this period is the mark had to remain at the old par. Because any even hint of devaluation of the mark, they would have had a revolution. So that was their thing. Here we have a situation where every currencies are collapsing, everybody goes off a gold standard, and the German mark is overvalued. What do you do about it if you can't devalue the mark? What the Germans did about it was to start, since they were outside then the international monetary order, since the mark was overvalued, they started a system of exchange controls and bilateral trade agreements. That they're really, in this sense, outside the multilateral system. And in the course of doing that, they were attacked bitterly by the United States as being evilly discriminatory and bilateral. But they're into bilateral trading agreements not because of any sinister plotting on their part, but because they could barely do anything else, given this factor they could not devalue the mark. I mean, politically, they could not devalue the mark. I'll continue reading here. Though caught with an overvalued par as each European country went off the gold standard, no German government could have politically succeeded in engaging once again in the dreaded act of devaluation. No longer on gold and unable to devalue the mark, Germany was obliged to engage in strict exchange controls. In this economic climate, Dr. Schacht was particularly successful in making bilateral trade agreements with individual countries, agreements which amounted to direct, quote, barter, unquote, arrangements, and angered the United States and other Western countries in totally bypassing gold and other international banking or financial arrangements. In the anti-German propaganda of the 1930s, the German barter deals were agreements in which Germany somehow invariably emerges coercive victor and exploiter of the other country involved, say Bulgaria or Romania, in exchanging manufactured goods for wheat, even though they were mutually agreed upon and therefore presumably mutually beneficial exchanges. Actually, there's nothing either diabolic or unilaterally exploitive about the barter deals. Part of the essence of the barter arrangements has been neglected by historians. The deliberate overvaluation of the exchange rates of both currencies involved in these deals. And typically what would happen. I'll continue. The German mark, we have seen, was deliberately overvalued as the alternative to the expector of currency depreciation. The situation of the other currencies was a bit more complex. Thus, in the barter agreements between Germany and the various Balkan countries, especially Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, and Yugoslavia, in which the Balkans exchanged agricultural products for German manufactured goods, the Balkan currencies were also fixed at an artificially overvalued rate vis-a-vis gold and the currencies of Britain and the other Western countries. So we had, the mark was overvalued in these agreements, particularly. The mark was overvalued, also the Bulgar and the Rum or whatever the names of these currencies are. This meant that Germany agreed to pay higher than world market rates for Balkan agricultural products, while the Balkan countries paid higher rates for German manufactured products. Now, what was the point of this? Who benefits from this peculiar arrangement where both currencies are overvalued? The point was that for the Balkan countries, the point was to force Balkan consumers of manufactured goods to subsidize their own peasants and agriculturists. In other words, this is an end run by which the Romanian government forces the Romanian consumer to subsidize the Romanian peasant. The Romanian consumer who buys manufactured goods is in this way forces, it's sort of like a New Deal farm program, so it's done roundabout through the currency system, the exchange rate and currency system. So the Romanian urban person or whatever, a businessman who buys manufactured goods is really subsidizing the Romanian peasant and landlord. The external consequence of this was that Germany was able to freeze out Britain and other Western nations from buying Balkan food and raw materials because they were paying a higher price. Germany was paying a higher price than the British would pay on the market. And since the British could not compete in paying for Balkan produce, the Balkan countries in the bilateral world in the 1930s did not have sufficient pounds sterling or dollars to buy manufactured goods from the West. Thus, Britain and the West were deprived of raw materials and markets for their manufactures by the astute policies of Hjalmar Schacht and mutually agreeable barter agreements between Germany and the Balkan and others, including Latin American countries. Of course, when they start dealing with Latin America, then really everything hits the fan. May not Western anger at successful German competition through bilateral agreements and Western desire to liquidate such competition have been an important factor in the Western drive for war against Germany? Lloyd Gardner has demonstrated the early hostility of the United States toward German economic controls and barter arrangements. As attempts to pressure Germany to shift to a multilateral open-door system for American products, and the repeated American rebuffs to German proposals for bilateral exchanges between the two countries. I have some other stuff here, and instead of integrating, I'll just sort of add the other stuff, which I've done since this paper has come out. Let's see, I hope that it works in. Huh? As early as June 26, 1933, the influential American Consul General in Berlin, George Messerschmitt, was warning that such continued policies would make, quote, Germany a danger to world peace for years to come. This is not, you know, this danger to world peace has nothing to do with any German troops marching or anything of that sort. It's German bilateral trade agreements, exchange controls. In pursuing this aggressive policy, President Roosevelt overrode AAA Chief George Peake, who becomes, well, at this point becomes a quote, isolationist, unquote, for World War II. I mean, from then on, Peake and Johnson, by the way, hive off the general foreign policy as it's beginning to shape up. George Peake, who favored accepting bilateral deals with Germany, and perhaps not coincidentally, was to be an ardent isolationist in the late 1930s. Instead, Roosevelt followed the policy of a leading interventionist and spokesman for an open door to American products, Secretary of State Cordell Hull, as well as his Assistant Secretary Francis B. Sayre, son-in-law of Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson pops up again, if only as an ancestor. By 1935, American officials were calling Germany an aggressor because of its successful bilateral trade competition, and Japan was similarly castigated for much the same reasons. By late 1938, G. Pierpont Moffat, head of the Western European Division of the State Department, was complaining that German control of Central and Eastern Europe would mean, quote, a still further extension of the area under a closed economy, unquote. And more specifically, in May 1940, Assistant Secretary of State Breckinridge Long warned that a German-dominated Europe would mean, quote, that every commercial order will be routed to Berlin, routed to Berlin, and filled under its orders somewhere in Europe rather than in the United States, unquote. So begin to see here that maybe the reason for the American drive to war with Germany, not for a crusade to save 6 million European Jews, but for less ideological, so to speak, less abstract and ideological reason. And shortly before American entry into the war, John J. McCloy, later to be U.S. High Commissioner of Occupied Germany and the number one establishment person in the Rockefeller Embassy, was to write in a draft for a speech by Secretary of War Henry Stimson, quote, with German control of the buyers of Europe and her practice of government control of world trade, it would be well within our power as well as the pattern she had thus far displayed to shut off our trade with Europe, with South America, and with the Far East, unquote. Not only were Hull and the United States ardent in pressing an anti-German policy against its bilateral trade system, but sometimes Secretary Hull had to whip even Britain into line, even our heroic ally, our looming heroic ally. Thus, in early 1936, Cordell Hull warned the British ambassador, and quote, the clearing arrangements reached by Britain with Argentina, Germany, Italy, and other countries were handicapping the efforts of this government to carry forward its broad program with a favored nation policy underlying it. In other words, the open door, multilateral, non-favored, most favored nation policy. The tendency of these British arrangements was, quote, to drive straight toward bilateral trading, and they were therefore milestones on the road to war. So here's a direct angry threat that, you know, you're pursuing the policy which the Germans have been pursuing of bilateral trading, and that's the road to war, and this is also going to be the road to war, presumably with us. One of the United States government's biggest economic worries was the growing competition of Germany and its bilateral trade in Latin America. Here it gets really hairy, of course. As early as 1935, Cordell Hull concluded that Germany was, quote, straining every tendon to undermine United States trading relations with Latin America, unquote. A great deal of political pressure was used to combat this competition. Thus, in the mid-1930s, the American Chamber of Commerce in Brazil repeatedly pressed the State Department to scuttle the Germany-Brazil barter deal. That was to put enormous political pressure on the Brazilians to scuttle it, which the Chamber termed, quote, the greatest single obstacle to free trade in South America. Brazil was finally induced to cancel its agreement with Germany in exchange for a $60 million loan from the United States. America's exporters, grouped in the National Foreign Trade Council, issued resolutions against German trade methods and pressured the government for stronger action. In late 1938, President Roosevelt asked Professor James Harvey Rogers, and we mentioned before as a big crisis stabilizer, an economist and disciple of Irving Fisher, to make a currency study of all of South America in order to, quote, to minimize, quote, German and Italian influence on this side of the Atlantic, unquote. There's no wonder the German diplomats in Brazil, Chile, and Uruguay reported home that the United States was, quote, exerting very strong pressure against Germany commercially, unquote, which included economic, commercial, and political opposition designed to drive Germany out of the Brazilian and other South American markets. In the spring of 1935, the German ambassador to Washington, desperately anxious to bring an end to American political and economic warfare, asked the United States what Germany could do to end American hostilities. The American answer, which amounted to a demand for unconditional economic surrender, was that Germany abandoned its economic policy in favor of America. In other words, abandon this whole bilateral trading, change control business, and allow us export, non-discriminatory export into Germany. I'll go a little bit more into that in a minute. The American reply really met, noted Pierpont Moffat, quote, a fundamental acceptance by Germany, and this is what we demanded in this reply, a fundamental acceptance by Germany of our trade philosophy and a thoroughgoing partnership with us along the road of equality of treatment and the reduction of trade barriers. That really means, of course, reduction of German trade barriers, not our trade barriers. The United States further indicated that it was interested that Germany accept not so much the principle of the most favored nation clause in all international trade, but specifically for American exports. So when push came to shove, we didn't really care about what Germany did with other countries, with imports from other countries. We were interested in, you know, what they do with American exports. a footnote here that it might be noted that in the spring of 1936, Secretary Hull refused to settle for a bilateral deal to sell Germany a large store of American cotton. Hull denounced the idea as blackmail. The predictable result was, in the next couple of years, the source of raw cotton imported into Germany shifted sharply from the United States to Brazil and Egypt, which had been willing to make barter sales of cotton. This starts the harass of the Brazilian problem. When war broke out in September 1939, Bernard Baruch's reaction, when you heard of this, was to tell President Roosevelt, quote, that if we keep our prices down, there is no reason why we shouldn't get the customers of the belligerent nations. If we keep our prices down, there is no reason why we shouldn't get the customers of the belligerent nations that they have had to drop because of the war. That was Baruch's first reaction. And nothing about saving 6 million Jews. His first reaction was the commercial question. And in that event, Baruch exulted that Germany's barter system will be destroyed. But particularly significant is a retrospective comment made by Secretary Hull. He made in his memoirs after the war. Quote, war did not break out between the United States and any country. War did not break out between the United States and any country with which we had been able to negotiate a trade agreement. It is also a fact that with very few exceptions, the countries with which we signed trade agreements joined together in resisting the Axis. The political lineup follows the economic lineup. Underline that. Now the thing is, you know, when I sort of knew about this when I was growing up in a graduate school, et cetera, and read this stuff, and the tendency that was sort of dismiss Hull as a free trade nut, and they kept making these statements, nobody believed them. And if we re-listen or reread Hull's statements in this regard and begin to take him seriously, say maybe news, after all, he was the Secretary of State during this whole period, if he says the major cause of war with Germany was this economic struggle, maybe he was right. At least there's a chance that he might be right. Or as I say here, considering that Secretary Hull was a leading maker of American foreign policy throughout the 1930s and through World War II, there's certainly a possibility that his remarks should be taken not as a quaint testimony to Hull's idée fixe and reciprocal trade, but as a positive causal statement of the thrust of American foreign policy. Read in that light, Hull's remark becomes a significant admission rather than a flight of speculative fancy. Reinforcing this interpretation be a similar reading of a testimony before the House of Representatives in 1945 of top Treasury aide Harry Dexter White, defending the Bretton Woods agreements, which we'll come to. White declared, quote, "I think it's the Bretton Woods system, which essentially is a general system of the United States in control instead of Britain. I think it would very definitely have made a considerable contribution to checking the war and possibly might have prevented it." What's he talking about if the war is over Jews and all that sort of stuff in the Rhineland and Danzig? and possibly might have prevented it. "A great many of the devices which Germany and Japan utilized would have been illegal in the international sphere had these countries been participating members." Is White saying that the Allies deliberately made war upon the Axis because of these bilateral exchange control and other competitive devices, which a Bretton Woods, or for that matter, 1920 system, would have precluded? And I wind out this part of the paper by noting the assertion of the influential London Times, well after the start of the war, that, quote, "One of the fundamental causes of this war," said this in October 1940, "one of the fundamental causes of this war has been the unrelaxing efforts of Germany since 1918, to secure wide enough foreign markets to straighten her finances at the very time when all of her competitors were forced by their own debts to adopt exactly the same course. Continuous friction was inevitable." Once again, we have the economic interpretation, this time of a very distinguished British journal. Okay, I have more which sort of fits in to this, going parallel, more or less. And here I refer to this forum, this module, which I just read fairly recently by Professor Thomas Etzold. I have the title and bibliography, something like "Why the United States Fought Germany in World War II." As a connoisseur to this, I happen to hear this undoubtedly unpublished. Professor Garrity of Columbia gave a very interesting, a long paper at the OAH, Organization of American Historians, meeting in Chicago this April. And the paper largely focused on the comment, Hitler and the Nazis' attitude toward the New Deal in the early period, 33, 35, etc., before the friction began. And it was laudatory. Hitler and the Nazis loved the New Deal, kept praising Roosevelt for doing in the United States what Hitler was doing in Germany, and fixing up the economic system and corporatizing it, and putting in saving capitalism or whatever the phraseology was. It was laudatory in the extreme. Okay, what went further things that went wrong in this multilateral business deals with the whole tariff question. But basically, one of the problems was that by German law, this had nothing to do with Hitler, this was the German system, tariffs were not a legislative matter. They were treaties negotiated with each country. So Germany would settle a tariff with Britain by having a treaty negotiation and find out the tariff there, and so forth and so on. In the United States, of course, tariffs are outside treaties. And tariffs are passed by Congress and have nothing to do with treaties. And so here we have this peculiar system. First of all, the United States, you see, can then insist that everybody else be multilateral. Because we're multilateral, we're not discriminating against German exports or French exports. When we raise our tariff 200%, we're keeping out everybody equally. We're not discriminating against any foreign country. So we can take a very high moral tone about non-discrimination and multilateralism. Meantime, the poor Germans did not have this kind of system. But since they negotiate a treaty, and the tariff is negotiated with each country, they can't be multilateral. It's almost impossible to be multilateral in the same sense. So we have this culture clash. And from the very beginning, from 1931 on, when this whole, whole thing collapses, the monetary thing collapses, the United States is constantly attacking Germany for discriminating against American products. And because of the way their thing is structured, they're not giving us this benefit of most favored nation clauses and so forth. And the Germans are accusing us of being hypocritical because they don't care that we're also keeping out Bulgarian products with our high tariff. They're worried about the fact that German exports are being kept out. We say, who cares about Bulgarian tariffs? That's a legislative matter. The point is we're not discriminating against you personally. So this goes on for the whole 1930s, this gap, communications gap, if you want to call it that. To be more specific, during the late 1920s, during the great foreign lending boom, Germany had been one of the largest creditors of the United States. It was a close symbiotic creditor-debtor relationship between the United States and Germany. By the time of the 1931 crash, American creditors had almost $700 million in German short-term securities and over $1.2 billion in long-term German securities. So we were they're virtually the biggest creditors. And comes the crash, and comes the overvalued markets. So the Germans had great difficulty in getting dollars up to pay the American creditors. This is one, another big. Well, there was one problem with the whole tariff caper. The other problem was the whole devaluation, overvaluation, bilateral agreements with Eastern Europe and Latin America. And the third problem was American creditors. American creditors are holding on to German bonds, and Germans have great difficulty getting dollars to pay off because they're not no longer in the multilateral picture. And the Germans are griping because our tariffs keep going up. And so they, how can they acquire dollars? It's a rather sensible position. We're telling them to get dollars and pay off American creditors, and they're saying, how can we acquire dollars if you won't buy German, allow us to sell German products in the United States? And the German exports to the United States kept falling because of the higher U.S. tariffs, the Smoot-Hawley tariff, for example, 31, which comes in this period. And the Germans now put on exchange controls to limit foreign exchange payments, because they have this, being, the mark being overvalued, they have the usual effect of that, which is a foreign exchange shortage. Means they have to ration dollars and pounds, etc. And the Germans, by 33, the Germans have reduced their service, in other words, their debt payment on these on medium and long-term German bonds, which are mostly debts of German municipalities, which we daily gave them during the great boom, foreign lending boom of the 20s, when we were practically. The bankers would go over to Germany, practically force them to borrow from them and build these city halls and German municipal works and that sort of thing. So Schacht was in this bind, and the policy, and Schacht blamed, Hull blamed Hitler because the Germans had reduced American debt payments in 1933. Actually, it was Schacht. Hitler was in favor of paying American debts. And Schacht told them, no, I can't do that because we haven't got the money. Schacht had been running this thing since 1931. And then Germany goes over by the summer of 1933 to this bilateral system where they announced that Germany would only buy abroad what it could pay for. It would limit its imports, the classical mercantilist thing, if you're in this bilateral thing, to limit their imports from each nation depending on the balance of trade. In other words, with a to try to have a balance of payment with each country. The quote on an American, they had a big balance of payments deficit with the United States, Germany at this point. So that means they had to coercively reduce American exports to Germany. Hull, of course, protested very bitterly, and we have this whole culture-economic conflict. And Hull is constantly attacking Germany for these quotas of reducing American exports to Germany and so forth. And there's also a whole complicated deal here, which I'm not going to go into, but where the German export, how the way German exchange control works. But anyway, there's a whole complicated scheme, which the Americans griped at, because again, this limited American exports to Germany. Meantime, and to aggravate all this, in 1933 and 1934, the United States discovered that Germany was paying their full debt service, the full debt charges, to other countries like Britain, Holland, Switzerland. So we get very riled up about this, and we demand an explanation from Schacht, and Schacht says, well, we have a dollar shortage, we have huge deficits in the balance of payments with the United States, because you know, he's on this bilateral ambit. And the United States announces this is illegal and all that sort of stuff. Hull is very legalistic, of course, at all times, especially when it fits his export ideology. And then we have this whole tariff thing and all that, which I've mentioned before. In March 1935, the Germans get panicky because the United States is getting more and more aggressive in this thing, refusing any kind of compromise. And Germany finally is ready to capitulate. It's okay, we accept the most favored nation principle. In the spring of 1935, to show their good faith, Germany resumes partial debt service on some of the U.S. held bonds, the German bonds. And Schacht even sent word to the United States he was ready to adopt the whole United States program, even the reciprocal trade treaty. This time they're getting pretty scared. So Hull decides that to, quote, test, unquote, German good faith. In his note of June 28, 35, he demands that Germany allocate foreign exchange and quotas and give the United States commerce its proportional share in the German market, sort of a quota, like something like a equivalent of affirmative action plans in the American university system now, and give an immediate quota and proportional share in the German market, and make reductions in German tariffs and U.S. exports. And we insisted, not only do we insist on this sort of overkill thing, unconditional economic surrender, as I mentioned before, but Hull insisted, this is typical Hullianism, which he repeats in his famous note of 1941 against Japan, that Germany would have to meet every one of these demands before we could even talk about it. This is the origin of this famous non-negotiable demand of the New Left. First you split your throat, and then we'll talk about the whole, sit down and talk about the whole thing. So all this, this fantastic ultimatum, really, on the German multilateral system, we insist that every clause has to be met before we, let's say, before we negotiate. Germany agreed, even after this ultimatum, this very nasty ultimatum, Germany agrees to meet all the conditions except one. They said they couldn't allocate dollars in advance. In other words, they couldn't before, they can't promise us and guarantee us foreign exchange, in other words, dollars to pay back our creditors in advance of payment, because they don't know how much dollars they're going to get. They don't know how they'll be able to do in the trade system, etc. So they can't guarantee this as an advance of trade and investment, because they couldn't be sure of a trade surplus with other countries so they can maneuver around and get dollars. Hull refused. Also, that's it. We tested their good faith and they've had it. From now on, everything is up the chute. This is when J. Pierpont Moffat commented that we demanded unconditional economic surrender, and of course that was the end of that. Okay, that's the New Deal international monetary system of the 30s. Now let's press on to Bretton Woods. And interestingly enough, there's a whole controversy among American diplomatic historians about what was America's war aims during World War II. I'm not, my expertise is not diplomatic history, but Harry M. Barnes, for example, claimed that our war aims are simply maximum killing of all Germans, as many Germans as possible. Whether or not that was true, we did have very definite economic monetary war aims, which we were very firm about from the very beginning of the war. Whether and to what extent German economic nationalism is a cause for the American drive toward war, missing a page here. One point was clear, that we had a clear war aim, and the economic monetary war aim. And the war aim was to reestablish an international monetary system. This national, competing national devaluation currency, etc., hadn't worked. It brought about war. We were going to reestablish a Genoa-type system with a couple of key differences. One difference was no more of this nonsense about domestic, because before that, in the 20s, the United States had redeemed in gold, the only currency redeemed in gold. Now we have differences. Nobody's going to redeem in gold domestically. The only gold redemption would be in foreign transactions, as the United States did in the 30s. The second difference is more politically far-reaching, for instead of two joint partner key currencies, the pound and the dollar, with the dollar as workhorse junior subaltern, the only key currency now is to be the dollar, which is to be fixed at $35 to the gold ounce. So now we have the new Bretton Woods, the so-called Bretton Woods, which has become the Bretton Woods system. The same gold exchange standard is going on, same business. So now everybody's pyramiding, these other nations, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, whatever, and Britain are pyramiding on top of the dollar. The dollar is now the key currency. Elbow Britain aside into the junior category with Bulgaria and so forth. The pound had it. And just as the United States was to use the Second World War to replace British imperialism with its own far-flung empire, so in the monetary sphere, the United States was now to move in and take over, with the pound no less subordinate than all the other major currencies. It was truly a triumphant dollar imperialism to parallel the imperial American thrust in the political sphere. As Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau Jr. was later to express it, the critical and eminently successful objective was, quote, to move the financial center of the world, unquote, from London to the United States Treasury. And this is what was done. And we might not have been successful in the political sphere, but we were certainly very successful, at least within this framework of our goals in achieving them. And all this was eminently in keeping with the prophetic vision of Cordell Hull, a man who, in the words of Gabriel Coco, had, quote, the basic responsibility for American political and economic planning for the peace. For Hull had urged upon Congress as far back as 1932, way, way back, that America gird itself, quote, gird itself, yield to the law of manifest destiny, where we heard that before, and go forward as a supreme world factor economically and morally, unquote. World War II is the occasion for a new coalition to form behind the New Deal. I'll get back to the domestic New Deal here. A coalition which reintegrated many conservative internationalists and, quote, financial interests who had been thrown into opposition by the domestic statism or economic nationalism of the earlier New Deal. This reintegration of the entire conservative financial community was particularly true in the field of international economic and monetary policy. Here, Dr. Leo Pasvolsky, a conservative economist who had broken the New Deal on the scuttling of the London Economic Conference, returned to a crucial role as Secretary Hull's special advisor in post-war planning. Dean Acheson, also disaffected by the radical monetary measures of 1933-34, was now back as Assistant Secretary of State for Economic Affairs, playing a key role. And when the ailing Cordell Hull retired in late 1944, he was replaced by Edward Stettinius, son of a Morgan partner, himself former president of Morgan Oriented of United States Steel. Stettinius chose as Assistant Secretary of Economic Affairs the man who quickly became the key official for post-war international economic planning. William L. Clayton, the former leader of the Anti-New Deal Liberty League and chairman and major partner of Anderson, Clayton & Company, the world's largest cotton export firm. Clayton's major focus in post-war planning was to promote and encourage American exports, with cotton not unnaturally, never out of the forefront of his concerns. Even before American entry into the war, U.S. economic war aims were well-defined and rather brutally simple. They hinged on a determined assault upon the 1930s system of economic and monetary nationalism so as to promote American exports, investments, and financial dealings overseas. In short, the open door for American commerce. In the sphere of commercial policy, this took the form of pressure for reduction of tariffs on American products. That's foreign tariffs on American products. And the elimination of quantitative import restrictions on those products. In the Allied sphere of monetary policy, it meant the breakup of powerful nationalistic currency blocks and the restoration of an international monetary order based on the dollar, in which currencies would be convertible into each other at predictable and fixed parities, and there would be a minimum of national exchange controls over the purchase and use of foreign currencies. And even as the United States was prepared to enter the war to save its ally Great Britain, it was preparing to bludgeon the British at a time of great peril to abandon their sterling bloc, which they had organized effectively since the Ottawa Agreements of 1932. World War II would presumably deal effectively with the German bilateral trade and currency menace, but what about the problem of Great Britain? How do they solve that? British economists who had urged a policy of all-out economic and monetary nationalism on behalf of inflation and full employment. He had gone so far as to hail Roosevelt's torpedoing the London Economic Conference, because the path was then clear for economic nationalism. Keynes's visit to Washington on behalf of the British government in the summer of 1941 now spread gloom about the British determination to continue their bilateral economic policies after the war. High State Department official G. Pierpont Moffat despaired, quote, "The future is clouding up rapidly, and despite the war, the Hitlerian commercial policy will probably be adopted by Great Britain." So what do we do about this? Are we going to start bombing Britain after we get rid of the German menace? The United States responded by putting the pressure on Great Britain at the Atlantic Conference in August 1941, the famous physical Atlantic Charter Conference. Under Secretary of State Sumner Welles insisted that the British agree to remove discrimination against American exports and abolish their politics of autarky, exchange controls, and imperial preference blocks. Prime Minister Churchill tartly refused, but the United States was scarcely prepared to abandon its crucial aim of breaking down the sterling bloc. As President Roosevelt privately told his son Elliot of the Atlantic Conference, this was in the days when Elliot's books were authorized by FDR, etc. Quote, "It's something that's not generally known." This is Roosevelt talking to his, to, you know, his kid at his knee. It's something that's not generally known, but British bankers and German bankers have had world trade pretty well sewn up in their pockets for a long time. Well, now, that's not so good for American trade, is it? If in the past German and British economic interests have operated to exclude us from world trade, kept our merchant shipping closed down, closed us out of this or that market, and now Germany and Britain are at war, what should we do? Unquote. So Roosevelt, at least, apparently, in addition to Hull and these other guys, are also thinking in economic determinist foreign trade, etc., monetary terms, rather than high moral principle. The signing of Lend-Lease agreements was the ideal time for wringing concessions from the British, but Britain consented to sign the agreement's Article 7, which merely involved a vague commitment to the elimination of discriminatory treatment in international trade, only after intense pressure by the United States. The agreement was signed at the end of February 42, and in return, the State Department pledged to the British that the U.S. would pursue a policy of economic expansion and full employment after the war. It means inflation. Parenthesis, inflation. Even under these conditions, however, Britain soon maintained the Lend-Lease Agreement committed it to virtually nothing after all. To Cordell Hull, however, the agreement, and our old legalist friend Cordell Hull, the agreement on Article 7 was decisive and constituted, quote, a long step toward the fulfillment after the war of the economic principles for which I had been fighting for half a century, unquote. Interesting turn of phrase there. The United States also insisted that other nations receiving Lend-Lease sign a virtually identical commitment to multilateralism after the war. So this is part of the quid pro quo for Lend-Lease. In the first major public address, you notice how hard-headed and consistent we are in this aspect of our foreign policy. In his first major public address in nearly a year, Hull, in July 1942, could now look forward confidently to, quote, leadership toward a new system of international relationships and trade and other economic affairs will devolve very largely upon the United States because of our great economic strength. We should assume this leadership and the responsibility that goes with it primarily for reasons of pure national self-interest. In the post-war planning for economic affairs, the State Department was in charge of commercial and trade policies, while the Treasury conducted the planning in the areas of money and finance. In charge of post-war international financial planning for the Treasury was the economist Harry Dexter White. In early 1942, White presented his first plan, which was to be one of the two major foundations of the post-war monetary system. White's proposal was, of course, within the framework of American post-war economic objectives. The countries of the world were to join a stabilization fund, totaling $5 billion, which would lend funds at short term to deficit countries to iron out temporary balance of payments difficulties. But in return for this provision of greater liquidity and short-term aid to deficit countries, exchange rates of currencies were to be fixed in relation to the dollar and hence the gold, with the gold price to be set at $35 an ounce, and exchange controls were to be abandoned by the various nations. While the White Plan envisioned a substantial amount of inflation to provide greater currencies to liquidity, the British responded with a Keynes plan that was far more inflationary. By this time, Lord Keynes had abandoned economic and monetary nationalism for Britain under severe American pressure, and his aim was to salvage as much domestic inflation and cheap money for Britain as he could possibly induce America to accept. The Keynes plan envisioned an international clearing union, which in return for agreeing to stable exchange rates between currencies and the abandonment of exchange control, provided a huge loan fund to its members of $26 billion, in contrast to the $5 billion in the White plan. The Keynes plan, moreover, provided for a new international monetary unit, the Bank Corps, which could be issued by the clearing union in such large amounts as to provide almost unchecked room for inflation, even in a country with a large deficit in its balance of payments. You see, the thing is, this was the Keynes plan, now Bernstein and Triffin, the American establishment. The goal which they're aiming for is a world bank, I mean, a real world bank, a world reserve bank, issuing a world paper unit, a Bank Corps, UNITAR, whatever you want, SDR, whatever you want to call it. And then you see, I can issue this in unlimited amounts. This would be the world currency. Gold would be kicked out. This would be the world currency. And then the World Bank could issue, if any country has a balance of payments deficit, because it's inflating too much, the World Bank issues more UNITARs or bank orders and ships them to the United States, say, the United States ships them to Germany, and Germany is stuck with the UNITARs. And then the World Bank can then coordinate a worldwide inflation, like the Federal Reserve is coordinating nationwide inflation. So this is the great objective and goal of coordinated worldwide unlimited inflation of the American monetary establishment. The nations, in the Keynes plan, the nations would consult with each other about correcting balance of payments disequilibria through altering their exchange rates. Keynes' plan, furthermore, provided automatic access to the fund of liquidity, but none of the embarrassing requirements, as included in the White Plan, for deficit countries to cease creating deficits by inflating their currency. Whereas the White Plan authorized the Stabilization Fund to require deficit countries to cease inflating in return for fund loans, the Keynes plan envisioned that inflation would proceed unchecked, with all the burden of necessary adjustments to be placed on the hard money creditor countries. This is now popping up in the idea that Japan and Germany have to keep raising their value of the mark and the yen, etc., instead of the dollar being devalued. The hard money creditor countries would be expected to inflate faster themselves in order not to gain currency from the deficit nations. The White Plan was stringently attacked by the conservative nationalists and inflationists in Britain, particularly G.R. Boothby, Lord Beaverbrook, the London Times, and the London Economist. The Keynes Plan was attacked by conservatives in the United States, as was even the White Plan, for interfering with market forces and for automatic extension of credit to deficit countries. Critical of the White Plan were the Guarantee Survey of the Guarantee Trust Company and the American Bankers Association. Furthermore, the New York Times and New York Herald Tribune called for return of the classical gold standard and attacked the large measure of government financial planning envisioned by both the Keynes and White proposals. After negotiating during 1943 until the spring of 44, the United States and Britain hammered out a compromise of the White and Keynes plans in April 1944. The compromise was adopted by a World Economic Conference in July at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. It was Bretton Woods that was to provide the monetary framework for the post-war world up until 1971. It started cracking very visibly in 68, and 71 put the final kibosh to it. The compromise established an international monetary fund as a stabilization mechanism. Its total funds were fixed at $8.8 billion, far closer to the White than the Keynes prescriptions. Its balance of IMF international control is against domestic autonomy lay between the White and Keynes plans, leaving the whole problem highly fuzzy. In other words, it was very fuzzy about how much control the IMF would have over the deficit countries and how much could they force them to stop inflating and so forth. On the one hand, national access to the fund was not to be automatic. On the other, the fund could no longer require corrective domestic economic policies of its members. On the question of exchange rates, the Americans yielded to the British insistence in allowing room for domestic inflation even at the expense of stable exchange rates. The compromise provided that each country could be free to make a 10% change in its exchange rate, and the larger changes could be made to correct fundamental, quote, fundamental disequilibria, unquote. In short, that a chronically deficit country could devalue its currency rather than check its own inflation, at least by 10%. And there would be actually more than that. If the so-called disequilibria fundamental, you know what that means. Furthermore, the United States yielded again on allowing creditor countries to suffer and permitting deficit countries to impose exchange controls on so-called scarce currencies. In after World War II, for example, it was the dollar that was scarce because the dollar was harder in other countries. And so we permitted, in this agreement, we permitted European inflationary countries to put exchange controls on the dollar. This meant, in effect, the major European countries, whose currencies would be fixed at existing highly overvalued rates in relation to the dollar, in those days the dollar was the hard money, would thus be permitted to enter the IMF with chronically overvalued currencies and then impose exchange controls on scarce undervalued dollars, so-called scarce dollars. But despite these extensive concessions, there was no bank core, no Keynesian bank core. The dollar, fixed at $35 per gold ounce, was now to be firmly established as a key currency base of a new world monetary order. The size for the dollar to be undervalued and other major currencies to be overvalued greatly spurs American exports. So this is hot chaw for American exports, which is one of the basic aims of the entire operation. U.S. Ambassador to Great Britain John G. Wynant recorded the deceptive hostility to the Bretton Woods Agreement by the majority of the directors of the Bank of England. For these men saw, quote, says Wynant, that if the plan is adopted, financial control will leave London and sterling exchange will be replaced by dollar exchange. Quote, the proposed International Monetary Fund ran into a storm of conservative opposition in the United States from the opposite pole of the hostility of the British nationalists and wanted to inflate more. The American attack on the IMF was essentially launched by two major groups, conservative Eastern bankers and Midwestern isolationists. Among the bankers, the American Bankers Association attacked the unsound and inflationary policy of allowing debtor countries to control access to international funds. And W. Randolph Burgess, president of the American Bankers Association, denounced the provision for debtor rationing of scarce currencies as an, quote, an abomination, unquote. The New York Times urged rejection of the IMF and proposed making loans to Britain in exchange for the abolition of exchange controls and quantitative restrictions on imports. Another banker group came up with a so-called key currency proposal as a substitute for Bretton Woods. This key currency plan was proposed by economist John H. Williams of Harvard, also vice president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and endorsed by Leon Fraser, president of the First National Bank of New York, and by Winthrop W. Oldrich, head of the Chase National Bank. This envisioned a bilateral pound-dollar stabilization, really getting back to the old Genoa thing, fueled by a large transitional American loan or even grant to Great Britain. Thus, the key currency people were ready to abandon temporarily not only the classical gold standard, but even an international monetary order, and to stay temporarily in a modified version of the world of the 1930s. The Midwestern isolationist critics of the IMF were led by Senator Robert A. Taft, Republican of Ohio, who charged that while the bulk of the valuable hard money placed in the fund would be American dollars, the dollars would be subject to international control by the fund authorities, and therefore by the debtor countries. The debtor countries could then still continue exchange controls and sterling block kind of practices. Here, Taft failed to realize that formal and informal structures in the Bretton Woods design would ensure effective United States control of both the IMF and the Allied International Bank, which we don't have to go into. The administration countered the critics of Bretton Woods with a massive propaganda campaign, which was able to drive the agreement through Congress by mid-July 1945. The campaign emphasized that the U.S. government would have effective control, at least of its own representatives in the fund. It played up, in what proved to be gross exaggeration, the favorable aspects of the various ambiguous provisions, insisting that debtor access to the fund would not be automatic, that exchange controls would be removed, and exchange rates would be stabilized. It pushed heavily the vague idea that the fund was crucial to post-war international cooperation to keep the peace. Particularly interesting was the argument of William L. Clayton and others that Bretton Woods would facilitate the general commercial policy of eliminating trade discrimination and barriers against American exports. This argument was put particularly boldly by Secretary of Treasury Morgenthau in a speech to Detroit industrialists. Morgenthau promised that the Bretton Woods agreement would lead to a world trade free from exchange controls and depreciated currencies, and this would greatly increase the exports of American automobiles. Since the fund would begin operations the following year, by accepting the existing grossly overvalued currency parity that most of the nations insisted upon, this meant that Morgenthau might have known whereof he spoke. For if other currencies are overvalued and the dollar undervalued, American exports are indeed encouraged and subsidized. It is perhaps understandable that not only the major farm, labor, and New Deal liberal organizations pushed for Bretton Woods, but also the large majority of industrial and financial interests also approved the agreements and urged its passage in Congress. American approval in mid-1945 was followed after lengthy soul-searching by the approval of Great Britain at the end of the year. By the end of its existence, therefore, the Second New Deal had established the triumphant dollar as the base of a new international monetary system. The dollar had displaced the pound, and within the general political framework in which the American Empire had replaced the British. Looking forward perceptively to the post-war world in January 1945, Lamar Fleming, Jr., president of Anderson Clayton and Company, wrote to his longtime colleague William Clayton that, quote, the British Empire and British international influence is a myth already, unquote. This is for our heroic allies. Rather nasty tone there. The United States would soon become the British protector against the emerging Russian landmass, prophesied Fleming. This will mean, quote, the absorption into the American Empire of the parts of the British Empire which we will be willing to accept, unquote. As the New Deal came to a close, the triumphant United States stood ready to reap its fruits on a worldwide scale. Let me get to the consequences maybe tomorrow. Well, maybe I'll just continue it. Since I'm on a monetary kick, I read you the epilogue also. The Bretton Woods Agreement established the framework of the international monetary system down to the present day. That means now in 1971. Was written a couple of years ago. A new and more restricted international dollar-gold exchange standard had replaced the collapsed dollar-pound-gold exchange standard of the 1920s. During the early post-war years, the system worked quite successfully within its own terms, and the American banking community completely abandoned its opposition. With the European currencies inflated and overvalued, and European economies exhausted, the undervalued dollar was the strongest and hardest of world currencies. A world dollar shortage prevailed, and the dollar could base itself upon the vast stock of gold in the United States, much of which had fled from war and devastation abroad. But in the early 1950s, the world economic balance began slowly but emphatically to change. For a while, the United States, influenced by Keynesian economics, proceeded blithely to inflate the dollar, seemingly relieved of the limits imposed by the classical gold standard. Several European countries began to move in the opposite direction. Under the revived influence of conservative, free market, and hard money-oriented economists in such countries as West Germany, France, Italy, and Switzerland, these newly recovered countries began to achieve prosperity with far less inflated currencies. Hence, these currencies became ever stronger and harder, while the dollar became softer and increasingly inflated. In this connection, the key people, interestingly enough, in this whole thing, leading these various countries toward much harder money and less inflation, were all students of Ludwig von Mises, sort of the last Austrian economist on the board. West Germany, the West German policy, both in free trade and free market and hard money, Ludwig Erhard, was essentially influenced by his theoretician, economist Alfred Müller-Armack, who was a student of Wilhelm Röpke in Switzerland, who in turn was a student of von Mises in Austria. So they have this whole Mises-Röpke-Müller-Armack connection. In France, Jacques Rouff was hard at work, and I mentioned before, was also a Mises student. And in Italy, Luigi Arnoldi, president of Italy, had a great deal of influence on shifting Italy rightward after World War II, was also a friend and colleague, and I found a student who was closely associated with Mises from a long time in Italy. So this is sort of like the last gasp of the old Austrian influence. The continuing inflation of the dollar began to have two important consequences. One, that the dollar was increasingly overvalued in relation to gold, and two, that the dollar was also increasingly overvalued in relation to the West German mark, the French and Swiss francs, the Japanese yen, and other hard money currencies. The result was a chronic and continuing deficit in the American balance of payments, beginning in the early 1950s and persisting ever since. The consequence of the chronic deficit was a continuing outflow of gold abroad and a heavy piling up of dollar claims in the central banks of the hard money countries. Since 1960, the foreign short-term claims of American gold have therefore become increasingly greater than the U.S. gold supply. In short, just as inflation in England and the United States during the 1920s led finally to the breakdown of the international monetary order then, so has inflation in the post-war key country, the United States, led to increasing strains and fissures in the triumphant dollar order of the post-World War II world. Well, footnote to that, of course, led now to the breakdown of that system, too. It has become increasingly evident that an ever more inflated and overvalued dollar cannot continue as a permanently secure base of the world monetary system, and therefore this ever more strained and insecure system cannot long continue in anything like its present form. This is written like a 6 months or a year before like a big crash. In fact, the post-war system has already been changed considerably in an ultimately futile attempt to preserve its basic features. In the spring of 1968, a severe monetary run on the dollar by Europeans redeeming dollar claims led to two major changes. One was the partial abandonment of the fixed $35 per ounce gold price. Instead, a two-price or two-tier gold price system was established. The dollar and gold were allowed to find their own level in the free gold markets of the world, with the United States no longer standing ready to support the dollar in the gold market at $35 an ounce. On the other hand, $35 still continues as a supposedly eternally fixed price for the world central banks, who are pledged not to sell gold in the world market or to buy it either. It's supposed to be completely sealed off from the free gold market. Keynesian economists were convinced that with a dollar and gold severed on the world market, also the Friedmanites too, I'm going to add, the price of gold would then fall in the freely fluctuating market. And all these guys were predicting, except for a couple of us crazy gold bugs, all the top economists in the country were predicting that the price of gold, now that it was no longer supported by the dollar, the price of gold would fall to its natural industrial price, you know, for jewelry and teeth and all that sort of stuff, of $10 an ounce. That was the firm prediction of Mothlop and Friedman and all these other guys. Of course, we now know it's something like $120 an ounce. It never fell below $35. It's skyrocketed. The reverse, however, has occurred since the world market continued to have more faith in the soundness and the relative hardness of gold than in the increasingly inflated dollar. The second change is the creation of special drawing rights, a new form of, quote, paper gold, unquote, of newly created paper which can supplement gold as an international currency reserve behind each currency. While this indeed put more backing behind the dollar, the quantity of SDRs has been too limited to make an appreciable difference to a world economy that trusts the dollar less with each passing year. Understatement at this point. These two minor repairs, however, failed to change the fundamental overvaluation of the ever more inflated dollar. In the spring of 1971, a new monetary crisis finally led to a massive revaluation of several of the hard currencies. If the United States suddenly refused to lose face by raising the price of gold or by otherwise devaluing the dollar down to its genuine value in the world market, then the harder currencies, such as West Germany, Switzerland, and the Netherlands, found themselves reluctantly forced to raise the value of their currency. This, of course, has been continuing since then, too. Their alternative, a massive calling upon the United States to redeem in gold, thereby the smashing of the facade of dollar redemption in gold, was too much of a political break with the U.S. for these nations to contemplate. Actually, this is what they did, apparently, August 71. I wrote this, obviously, in the spring of 71. By August 71, the central banks in Europe are beginning to say, look, we have $80 billion piled up of dollars here, and you got only $10 billion or $9 billion worth of gold to redeem it. We're going to start cashing in. We're sick of piling up the dollars. At that point, Nixon, you know, issues his famous August 1971 speech and puts on, freezes prices and has an old grand showboat kind of thing. In the meantime, he, as part of the thing, says, by the way, we're also ending all redemption in gold, period. For the United States to preserve the facade of gold redemption at $35, it has been using intense political pressure on its creditors to retain their dollar balances and not to redeem them in gold. By the late 1960s, General de Gaulle, under the influence of classical gold standard advocate Jacques Rouef, was apparently preparing to make just such a challenge, to break the dollar standard as a move toward destroying the classical gold standard in France and much of the rest of Europe. But the French domestic troubles in the spring of 68 ended that dream, at least temporarily, as France was forced to inflate the franc for a time in order to pay the overall wage increase and agreed upon under the threat of a general strike. What happened there, of course, is the workers are insisting on a general wage increase of 14% or whatever, and the French finally agreed to pay it, and they inflate the currency by 14%, and prices go up by 14%. At the end of the year, a year or so, French workers know better off than they were before, and the French franc has been softened. Despite these hasty repairs, it is becoming increasingly evident that they are makeshift stopgaps, and that a series of more aggravated crises will shake the international monetary order until a fundamental change is made. A hard money policy in the United States that put an end to inflation and increase the soundness of the dollar might sustain the current system. But this is so politically remote as to be hardly a likely prognosis. There are several possible monetary systems that might replace the present deteriorating order. A new system desired by the Keynesian economists and by the American government would be a massive accession of paper gold to demonetize gold completely and replace it by new monetary units, I mentioned before, such as the Keynesian Bank Corps, and a paper currency issued by a new World Reserve Bank. If this were achieved, then the new American-dominated World Reserve Bank would be able to inflate any currencies indefinitely and allow inflating currencies to pay for any and all deficits ad infinitum. While such a scheme embodied in the Triffin Plan, the Bernstein Plan, and others is now the American dream, it has met determined opposition by the hard money countries, and it remains doubtful that the United States will be able to force these countries to go along with the plan. The other logical alternative is the Rouef Plan, returning to the classical gold standard after a massive increase in the world price of gold. In other words, jack it up to $150, $200 an ounce, $300 or whatever, and then go back to the gold standard. But this too is unlikely, especially under overpowerful American opposition. Barring acceptance of a new world currency, the Americans would be content to keep inflating and simply force the hard money countries to keep appreciating their exchange rates. But again, it is doubtful that German, French, Swiss, and other exporters would be content to keep crippling themselves in order to subsidize dollar inflation. We still have that problem. Perhaps the most likely prognosis is the formation of a new hard money European currency bloc, which might eventually be strong enough to challenge the dollar politically as well as economically. In that case, the dollar standard will probably fall apart. We may see a return of the currency blocs of the 1930s with a European bloc, this time on a harder and quasi-gold basis. It is at least possible that the future will see gold and the hard European currencies at last dethrone the triumphant but increasingly uneasy dollar. But what we have now is essentially a 1930s back again, with shifts back and forth and then temporary. But we're getting to a prognosis for the monetary future is a pretty bleak one, because what we have is a situation where the whole old currency media broken down, and we have exchange rates shifting back and forth from fluctuating to fixed and various combinations of all this, a so-called dirty float where the exchange rate is supposedly fluctuating freely, but then the central bank sticks its nose in and interferes with this clean float, quotes. And what we can envision in this thing, since there doesn't seem to be any hope of restoring any kind of stable system, what we can envision is going back to the 30s, currency blocks, competing devaluations, export industries in control of the governments, and wanting to have one more devaluation to hype up your exports, higher tariffs, exchange controls, keeping out Japanese products, and all the rest of it. And if Kurt Hall was right that the political conflict follows economic conflict, we expect some hefty international wars, perhaps. One of my sort of quasi jokes, which really isn't it's only a half joke at best, is it's a darn good thing that Japan but isn't very fully armed yet. Otherwise, we could have provoked another Pearl Harbor and have another, you know, another war against the evil grinning Japanese, which would be coming back to the. So I hope that Japan continues to be, you know, relatively unarmed to avoid this kind of setup. Okay, this sort of covers the New Deal internationally. I'm going to try to get into some New Deal domestic stuff now.